Morning. It is Sunday, March 4th, 2012. Topic today is Dina Del Malchuta Dina. This was kind of a logical extension from what we were discussing about the contraception debate, where, you know, we discussed last week about specifics regarding contraception, and now we want to focus today on, you know, government telling, you know, us what to do, and to what extent do we have a halachic obligation, you know, to follow it. I made a reference to, I didn't want to include in the full sources here, but I made a reference to this pasuk in the drasha yesterday because Purim's coming up, is, you know, one of Haman's complaints to Ahasuerush was, Yeshno am echad mefuzar mefrad bein ha'amim, bechol medinot malchutecha, that there's this nation that's scattered, sort of an independent entity that's scattered amongst all of your nations, v'datem shonot mikol am, their laws are different, and underlined here, v'etate ha'melech einam osim, and they don't actually keep the laws of the king. Now, this probably, you know, we don't have like a full set of like, you know, offenses, but like it does kind of show that, you know, there was at least, you know, back then, real or imagined, a legitimate type of complaint is, oh, they're not actually doing what you say. So I thought that was a, you know, since it's Inyan Anti Yoma coming up, worthwhile including here.
Wasn't that a big part of like Moses Mendelssohn and people in the Enlightenment was to show that Judaism could be, instead of like a civil law, that it could be just a religion within, like Protestantism was within other countries, and that Jews could obey all the laws of the...
But in some respects it could, and, you know, throughout Europe they kind of had to.
Yeah.
You know, except laws. I mean,
except
you're under the thumb of another.
Because
it doesn't. Right. So we'll actually discuss that a little bit today. Mm-hmm. The three main questions asked with Dina Del Malchuta Dina. These are just three simple words. Literally, you know, that means the law of the land is law. And there are three questions you can ask here, you know, pretty much on each word. One, Dina, like that first thing, referring to the law of the land. Which laws? What laws are the ones that, you know, are we talking about here? Second one is Malchuta. What do you consider to be a legitimate government? Or for this purpose, is it specifically king, you know, king or anything else? And the last one is Dina. What does it mean, the law, from a Jewish perspective? And you're going to have debates on all three of those questions, which we're going to, you know, discuss outside, because you could imagine there's a huge wealth of material on, you know, written on this, because for three simple words, you know, it's, you know, relatively vague. We're going to focus primarily on the rabbinic sources. And just to set up, you know, from the outset, when you have statements like this, you can take either a minimalist or a maximalist position. A minimalist position would be only use this term or apply this term based on the specific contexts in which it was employed in the Gemara. Or you can take a general type of idea that it, you know, or at least expansion is possible, that it is really a general principle which can then be applied into many different areas in terms of any aspect of civil law. So we're not going to answer all of those questions, but we're certainly going to touch on many of those as we go through the primary sources here and to see, well, what are some analogous situations that they could be applicable today. All right? Awesome. So let's start off with the first section of sources are the rabbinic sources. These would be the instances in the Gemara. This only appears, the statement appears of Dina Del Malchuta, is only in the Babylonian Talmud. We'll see that it is only cited in the name of Shmuel. And that's always like, you know, Shmuel's dictum of Dina Del Malchuta Dina, that it is applied. It's not presented in the course of a normal conversation. And to get a bit academic Talmud-y here, when the compiler of the Gemara, you know, puts it in, it's not that there was an actual debate going on. It seems that it was a concern that people had. And you'll see, like, how it's read here. It's like, oh, but didn't Shmuel say, Dina Del Malchuta Dina? Like, wouldn't this be a problem? And then people, you know, the rabbis will then answer it based on that dictum. So even though, you know, it was only said in the name of Shmuel, to my knowledge, there's no one who, you know, says it's not true. And it was, you know, it was something that needed to be addressed based on some other rabbinic teachings. I can say at the outset, we're not going to get into it, but there's a, you know, some dispute amongst the Rishonim about whether or not it's even a biblical statement, meaning Dina Del Malchuta Dina, of, you know, the law of the land of the law in terms of attributed to Shmuel doesn't necessarily mean that he was the one that came up with the idea. Could very well mean that this is
Shmuel
actually...
Shmuel being a rabbi or Shmuel the prophet?
Shmuel being a rabbi, however, it's a great point, we're actually going to see how much of this dates back to Shmuel the prophet later on, specifically what's called Parshat Melech, with the thing of the king that's in a later source. But yes, thank you for bringing that up, because it is, in fact, you know, it is actually going to come up here. But yes, you could easily, you could, and there are, you know, people like that, it's actually a biblical idea that, you know, Shmuel might get credit for the aphorism, for taking this principle that either that existed, might have been pervasive long before Shmuel. Shmuel is Amora, like first generation Amora, but the idea of like, well, you have to follow what the civil courts say, you know, doesn't necessarily have to originate with him, right? Could have preceded him.
It might have been like a saying that people said when they were in other countries.
Well, maybe not. I mean, he was the first one that came up with Dina de Malchuta, but that doesn't mean that the concept that it represents, he might have been the one to just, you know, narrow
it
down.
He got into three words.
So, like, you know, and when you get, and there's a lot of that where you try to, you know, take these complicated teachings and make it in a way that's easier to remember. It's how some people describe the whole construct of the Mishnah, where you take out a lot of the debate and you just get it down to the most memorizable units because it's an oral tradition. So you'll quote Shmuel because he came up with, you know, this phrase, perhaps, even though generations before people were still operating under this assumption.
Mm-hmm.
All right? Questions already?
Do you have time
for questions? Yeah, sure, because we didn't start yet.
So two questions. I mean, one is sort of, what is the status of that dictum? Is it considered part of the oral Torah that, you know, if you're halachic, you have to obey it? Second is Shmuel normally part of the majority or the dissenting minority?
It's not that he's part of the majority or minority. He argues with Rav, a lot, but, you know, not all the time. And, you know, here you don't find Rav have any, you know, there's no record of Rav having any sort of objection to it. So whether or not he's normally part of the majority or minority, that only matters if there's a debate, right? When you don't have a debate and you don't have any statement to the contrary of Dina de Malchuta, then, you know, it doesn't matter. Then you're a majority of one because there's no opposition.
Yeah.
So, you know, in this case, it wouldn't matter. Yeah.
Sorry that this is sort of jumping ahead, but your sources don't appear to go beyond the year 1300.
That is correct, because if I have, you know, an hour or so, there's only so much I can do.
But okay, so just in general, has there been a lot more on the topic?
Are you kidding? Of course there has been. Sure. And we'll discuss some of the implications, you know, afterwards in terms of, you know, how things can go. But yeah, you're kidding? if it was so simple, like... Oh, yeah. Like, rarely will you find anything that a whole lot hasn't been written on. But Dina de Malchut in particular, because you could imagine... I mean, let's put it this way. Like, one plausible question you can have about Dina de Malchut is that... It is a rabbinic prohibition, or perhaps biblical, if that's you assume, Dina de Malchuta, to drive 65 in a 55 mile per hour zone.
Right.
All right? Because law of the land says this. It's a worthwhile question to consider, but I first wanted to get through the primary sources to at least deal with, you know, the minimalist position to see, well, to what extent would extending it make any sort of sense? And we threw in a little bit of parameters at the end. It's, you know, one of the disadvantages here about, you know, not being able to do something comprehensive. I mean, I'm sure someone could easily write a book just on the evolution of Dina de Malchut and Dina. Well, maybe not easily, but I think it could be done. If I'm going to have to excise anything, it would be the later sources, simply because by going back to the primary sources of the Gemara, if people want to go on and learn other stuff, they at least know the main sources that are going to be discussed. And they're going to know, like, here's, you know, like, if you look up, say, Rambam, you know, Rashba writes, you know, has some stuff on Dina de Malchuta, but the Rashba is not going to make any sense unless you know the Gemaras that he's referring to. So I would always try to go back as early as possible, because any subsequent conversation is going to be dependent on those sources. All right?
Thank you.
You're welcome. Really, start us off with, first we're going to do a Mishnah in Nedarim. And the reason we do the Mishnah, there are a few sources here where the Dina de Malchut de Dina we'll see in the Gemara is based specifically off of something in a Mishnah. So for context purposes, we have to know the case in the Mishnah. So the first is Nedarim, Mishnah 3-4.
One may vow to murderers, i.e. robbers who kill if their demands are not granted. Robbers, Rashi, Ron, Rush, and Tosafot.
Yeah, later commentators. The Tosefta wouldn't comment on a Mishnah. It's because they're about, you know, same time, but that's Tosafot.
Okay. All interpret this as private robbers. Jast? What is it?
Jast refers to Jastro, the dictionary.
Okay.
Refers to it as official oppressors, meaning you've got, you know, different, you know, types of robbers. The question is whether or not, you know, they're just, you know, individual marauders type, or are they actually, you know, official, you sanctioned.
Okay, these are less desperate than murderers and do not kill if their demands are refused. And publicans, that is... That is the produce which they demand is teruma, even if it's not.
Right. So to summarize this quickly, and you have like the gloss here is, you know, people are trying to say, you know, trying to take your stuff illegally, apparently. And you're allowed to say that, you're allowed to lie, basically, and to say that it's truma, even if it isn't, because they wouldn't be able to have it. And he puts in a clause here, it's remarkable that even murderers and robbers are assumed to respect the prohibition of truma. You know, which on one hand is, you know, a sad commentary. On the other hand, you know, you find this as far back as the Navi, where people were a lot more concerned with, you know, getting all the ritual stuff done and ignoring all the civil laws. Some things, it, you know, it exists in the time of the Navi, it exists in the time of all thing has changed.
They're assuming these robbers are Jewish.
Well, even if it's, well, yeah. Well, possibly for some
well, in
cases,
that case,
at least.
In that case,
I mean, because if well, maybe, maybe not. I mean, you couldn't, you know, possibly argue that, you know, someone who's not Jewish might still be considered of truma if there's a, you know, if there was a sign of like there's some mystical significance behind it, right? If you have somebody who's not Jewish who's, you know, whatchamacallit, you know, might be superstitious, wouldn't, but you know, could very well be. For you know, I think focusing on the Jewish, you know, well, I'll see in a second, like no, why.
Like
well, you'll see in a second. Well, for some of them, maybe, but the publicans seem to refer to more of an official government person. So unless you want to say that that refers to a particular a state-sanctioned Jewish collector, but it seems from at least that part of, you know, that you have an agent of the government, probably wouldn't have been Jewish. So, and then you have a discussion here about Beit Hillel and Shammai is, what is to what extent can you actually lie, whether or not it's a formal vow? So here you have a case of, you know, someone from the government is coming to take your food. You're allowed to lie to ensure that they don't take it. So skip to where it says 1b. So this is the Gemara in Nedarim 28a commenting on this Mishnah.
Okay. But Samuel said, the law of the country is law. With a question mark? Therefore,
well, yeah, because it's written as a question. It's like, right. How could you say that if, you know, let's say referring to a state official, right? I don't think there's a law that if, you know, someone mugs you, you have a, you know, a state law of Dina de Malchuta to give the robber. You might have an obligation to save your life. But if you have, like, the government's coming to, you know, take an agent of the government, you know, for tax purposes, why can you lie to him? Like, the Mishnah says you can. And the question then is like, but wait, Shmuel said, Dina til Malchuta Dina. Now, keep in mind, Shmuel, you know, came after the Mishnah, right? So, you know, on one hand, you can say, like, you're holding a Mishnah accountable to a statement made by Shmuel. The fact that it's, you know, taken seriously is like, well, you know, it's probably an earlier type of ethic that Shmuel just concretized into three words.
Okay.
All right?
Therefore, the publican has a legal claim. Why, then, is the owner permitted to evade payment by a false vow? Rabbi Hanina said that in the name of Rabbi Kahana, in the name of Samuel, the Mishnah refers to a publican who is not limited to a legal due. Under the Roman procurators, there was a tremendous amount of illegal extortion. The school of Rabbi Janai answered, this refers to an unauthorized collector.
So there are two possible answers here. One, provided in the name of Shmuel himself, that there's a distinction between someone, like, let's say, a tax collector who is doesn't have, like, there's no limit to what he's doing. You know, if you have a tax collector, you'd say, like, he's trying to get, you know, the law would basically say, you know, he's supposed to get 10%. And the tax collector is saying, well, I want 15%, you know, 10% for the government and 5% for me, right? such corruption, you know, is probably not uncommon.
And there was probably a lot of freelancing targeted at Jews, tax collecting or agency.
Perhaps. I mean, you know, look, you go after whoever has money. And, right. You know, even if they don't have money, you go after whoever, you know, is going to get you money. And the other one is someone who is unauthorized. So, you know, Raviane's answer is the reason why you're allowed to lie in this case is just because you're a government official doesn't mean that's necessarily, you know, your mandate. You know, a Department of Education is not the IRS. And if the Department of Education starts hitting you up for money, you know, that's not the same thing as an agent of the government. You have to be authorized to actually get your, you know, get the money here. So here, right, context one is you're talking about some type of taxes, which is how it's employed, where the government seems to be, based on this, entitled to collect money as part of the law of the land is the law. Two qualifications. You know, we can argue whether or not there's actually a dispute, whether or not it's either or both of them are valid. Option one is that if an individual, I mean, both of these seem to be that he's not acting under the auspices of the government, either because the individual is asking more than the Malchut wants, or he wasn't actually given that mandate from the government, in which case it's not the reason why you're allowed to lie to this particular person is because he's not really doing the din of the Malchut. He's not actually doing the law of the land. Yeah.
Could we sort of extend this to something like having bank accounts in the cane?
Not yet. Hold off on certain scenarios until we get through a little bit more to sort of put the parameters down. Okay, so similar type of case, Dana, this is starting with the Mishnah in Bava Kamma 10:1.
Okay, so no money may be taken in change either from the box of the customs collectors or from the purse of the tax collectors. Nor may charity be taken from them, though it may be taken from their own coins, which they have at home or in the marketplace.
Mm-hmm. Gemara Bava Kamma 1:13, A to B. Yeah, go ahead.
Hi.
2B here.
So, in the case of customs collectors, why should the dictum of Samuel not apply that law of this? Why should the dictum of Samuel not apply that the law of the state is law? Why then are customs collectors considered as acting unlawfully? Rav Chanina ben Kahana said that Samuel stated that a customs collector who is bound by no limit is surely not acting lawfully. Mm-hmm. At the school of Rav Yanai, it was stated that we are dealing here with a customs collector who acts on his own authority without the authority of the ruling power.
It's the same type of, you know, case here. Continues, continuing that source after the ellipses, I took out, related but, you know, somewhat off the topic section just purely for Dina de Malchuta. So continuing.
Okay, the above text stated, Samuel said, the law of the state is law. Said Rava.
Should be Rava. I thought I said that. Yeah.
Sorry. Wasn't looking at the Hebrew.
No. Well, here's the thing. When Cincino is a weird translation error, if it's Rava, they do R-A-B-B-A-H. If it's Rava, they just do R-A-B-A.
Okay.
And I thought I did a find replace on that, but I guess it didn't take.
All right. So said Rava, you can prove this from the fact that the authorities fell palm trees without the consent of the owners and construct bridges with them. And we nevertheless make use of them by passing over them.
Mm-hmm.
But Abaye said to him, this is so, perhaps because the proprietors have meanwhile abandoned their right in them, without the authority of the ruling power. He, however, said to him, this is Rava to Abaye.
Yeah.
He, however, said to him, if the rulings of the state had not the force of law, why should the proprietors abandon their right?
Mm-hmm.
Still, as the officers do not fully carry out the instructions of the ruler, since the ruler orders them to go and fell the trees from each valley in equal proportion, and they come and fell them from one particular valley, why then do we make use of the bridges which are thus constructed from misappropriated timber? The agent of the ruler is like the ruler himself and cannot be troubled to arrange the felling in equal proportion. And it is the proprietors who bring this loss on themselves, since it was for them to have obtained contributions from the owners of all the valleys and handed over the money to defray the public expenditure.
If we can summarize this in two words, it's basically eminent domain.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a lot to, you know, see, it's a nice way of, like, you know, you take a lot of words and you can shirt down into two. But according to this, the state has a right to appropriate, you know, property for, you know, public works, and that's considered legitimate. It's not considered, it's the only, you know, the government can come in and say, you know what, we're going to take this and we need access to this.
But eminent domain means that the previous owner gets compensation.
It's not an exact parallel, obviously. Oh, okay. You know, because if you're a key, you could, in fact, you know, just take. There's no, you know, sense here. Although at the end here, you know, it seems to say that, you know, the proprietors of the cells, in the sense it was for them to have obtained contributions from the owner of all the valley. So, I mean, maybe, you know, there was some other, you know, corruption going on there. Maybe it's not direct compensation for it. All right. So we have, like, it's not, we, you know, have a repetition of the law regarding taxes about maybe a distinction there's that the agent has to actually be acting under the authority. And the second thing about land, we have an added power of that as long as he's, you can have an agent that's acting in the name of a king that for all intents and purposes is like the king himself. Assuming, of course, he has the mandate to do so. Meaning if the king says, you know, do X, Y, Z, like, you know, there's a certain rule that he doesn't have to, he doesn't have to, you know, be as, you know, detailed, or, you know, he doesn't have to, you know, he gets a certain degree of latitude in a way that it's not necessarily exact, which kind of goes against, you know, the tax collecting thing. Unless you want to say that, you know, maybe for certain things like, you know, trying to get equal value for land, which is a little bit trickier, especially when you're, you know, tearing down trees. Like, if you want to have certain things, you know, maybe you need a little bit more. That seems to be excusable. Hitting someone up for more money doesn't seem to be excusable. I mean, maybe the difference there is that, you know, money is something that's a little bit more objective. It's something that's, you know, easily calculable, whereas the other stuff isn't. You know, I don't know. You can leave that up as a question there. Yeah.
Okay, it seems like in both the first case we started with,
mm-hmm.
and this one, if there's corruption going on,
mm-hmm.
why do we have to deal with things like, why do we even have to think about things like vows? Why can't we just say no?
Because people who are corrupt might kill you. We're under the assumption here that you don't want to die.
But one second. If there are people who are going to kill you...
Yeah.
In the first case, they're going to say, okay, I won't kill you because this is true.
Yeah, that was the, you know, gloss that, you know, Cincino put in, which I put in the bracket, that it seems a little bit, you know, strange that they would do that.
Yeah.
But yeah, you would... You know, apparently it would be effective, or at least, you know, it's a way to get around it. But focusing just on the government, right? If you have a government official, even if he doesn't kill you directly, could certainly turn you into the government, which you certainly don't want to have happen,
yeah.
Right? So why would be a good way to get around it? Right?
Okay.
A little more pragmatic there.
Okay.
Alrighty. So those deal with certain, you know, degrees of finances. Move on to 3A. We have a, I should have put an end there, Mishnah Gittin 1:5.
Mishnah. All documents which are accepted in heathen courts, even if they that signed them were Gentiles, are valid for Jewish courts, except writs of divorce and of emancipation.
Mm-hmm.
Rav Shimon says these also are valid. They were only pronounced to be invalid when drawn up by unauthorized persons.
Mm-hmm. All right, continue. This is Gemara and Gittin 10b.
Gemara. Our Mishnah lays down a comprehensive rule in which no distinction is made between a sale and a gift. We can understand that the rule should apply to a sale because the purchaser acquires the object of sale from the moment when he hands over the money the non-Jewish judge's presence. And the document is a mere corroboration. For if he did not hand over the money in their presence, they would not take the risk of drawing up a document of sale for him. But with a gift, it is different. Through what does the recipient obtain possession? Through this document, is it not? And this document is a mere piece of clay? Assuming a deed originating in a non-Jewish court does not constitute an instrument of acquisition, why should the deed be deemed valid? Said Shmuel, the law of the government is the law. Or if you prefer, I can reply, instead of accept writs of divorce in the Mishnah, read accept documents like writs of divorce.
Right. So one of the, you know, the operative question here, if you know, the whole discussion is, you have a Mishnah that says that, you know, courts documents from the non-Jewish courts are valid in a Jewish court. They're admissible. And one of the answers given as to why that is so is Shmuel, if the law of the land is the law. Right? Now, there is an alternative here of, like, you know, maybe that, you know, it's only, you know, certain things are acceptable, but not everything. Meaning, writs of divorce, a get, and a shtar shechur are different documents in terms of halachic contracts are more significant, because beyond just dealing with money in terms of like who owes what, it affects a change in halachic status of the individual. Mm-hmm. For a woman who gets a divorce, it means she's now able to marry someone else. For an eved who becomes free, gets on more mitzvot and also affects whom he marries. So there's a much greater requirement there. It's not as, it's not just the same as a discovery thing of trying to prove like such and such is the case. Like, I owe you money. How do I know I owe you money? Because I have this document. There's an additional ritual halacha component for shtar shechrur and a get that you would have from just a regular transactional type of document. According to one opinion, you know, at least one explanation in this Gemara, the idea of dina de machute dina applies to contracts. Right? Because, right? You know, maybe even to understand it, because assuming that you've got some, judicial system of jurisprudence, you know, let's say today, you know, law students all have to take, I think all law students have to take a class in contracts, but it seems to be like a fairly basic law school class. You know, there's laws about contracts, and, you know, to ensure that something, you know, is fair. Now, does that necessarily meet the halachic definition, you know, of like a Jewish contract? Well, not necessarily, but what is the point of such a contract? Right? Or let's say focus on transactional contracts of like, I do this for you, like I owe you something or you owe me something under certain conditions. If it meets certain forms, you can actually uphold those. Right? And the principle being dina de malchuta dina. Like, given that, you know, there's a law of the land in terms of how these things are supposed to work, you can rely on that. At least, or not just rely on that, it seems, you know, would in fact be upheld by a beis din. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The relationship between the last sentence and the sentence before it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, law of the government is the law, meaning that would sort of extend the validity of the documents.
Mm-hmm.
The last sentence seems to contract the validity of the documents.
Yes, and not really, because all the last sentence does, it doesn't contract it at all. It sort of uses what the Mishnah says itself to answer the question. And the question is, why do we consider them valid? So the answer is, well, any document except those like the Bill of Divorce and the others, which the Mishnah had already stated.
Oh, okay.
So it's not really a limiting factor. It's just a way of, you know, trying to explain, you know, the teaching there.
This would clear up a lot of the a lot of current problems. Now, if I personally think that marriage should be should be separated from the kind of like tax. All the contractual things that come with marriage, that it shouldn't be like an official state. It should be like marriage should be something that's like something cultural. And then, you know, if you want to draw up contracts with people as far as like living together and things like that, mm-hmm. To get the benefits of taxes or whatever, pay health insurance and things mm-hmm. like that, it should be a totally separate thing.
Well, that was kind of the argument with the civil union thing. Like,
yeah,
because,
yeah.
You know, view a marriage more as a financial merger, yeah. Whether or not people call it marriage is, you know, independent. People are saying, you know, whenever people talk about the sanctity of marriage, the very word sanctity has a religious implication.
Right.
And if you're really serious about, you know, the
sanctity,
separation of church and state and marriage, you know, there's a sanctity to marriage, then the government shouldn't be involved at
in
all,
yeah.
By definition. In which case, you could just set up civil unions. You might not even have, like, and just like you have any sort of corporate merger, right. Set up certain rules about what types of mergers you will allow.
Right.
And as far as the state is concerned, it's only, like as you said, for tax purposes, health insurance, you right. know, next of kin type things, and get right. rid of marriage. And let, you know, people can say, everyone has civil unions.
Yeah, culturally, and they could do
culturally, marriage. Like, you call this a marriage, you call that a marriage, but from a legal perspective, it doesn't matter. That would solve a lot of problems. Yeah. I don't think anyone's going to go for it because it's just such an emotionally charged topic. just make civil unions for everyone from a legal perspective and let people on their own decide what's marriage. It's far too logical for it to ever take off.
Knowing
this. Yeah, people have too much
But
this
seems to hit the crux of it here, though. It seems to suggest that.
Well, in a sense, yes, because you don't want to have the government, a secular government, interfering with Jewish ritual law.
Right, exactly.
Gemara Bava Batra 54b to 55a. Rav Judah said in the name of Samuel, the property of the heathen, the reference appears from what follows, is to property sold by a heathen to an Israelite who had paid the money but not yet received the deal of sale, is on the same footing as desert land. Whoever occupies it acquires ownership. The reason is that as soon as the heathen receives the money, he ceases to be the owner, whereas the Jew does not become the owner until he obtains the deed of sale. I mean, there's a difference in terms of kinyan, of methods of acquisition for land, whereas for a non-Jew, there's the transference for one. I mean, normally when you have a transference, the two things happen at the same time, where I give you money, right, and then there's one transaction which shifts the ownership where it no longer becomes yours and it becomes mine. Mm-hmm. Right? Hefker would be a thing where I give up my rights to it, but someone else needs to come and claim it. Mm-hmm. Whereas, so here, if I'm having a transaction, the problem here is that there's, some liminal state where it's no longer, the non-Jew's property, but it's no longer mine yet. Because I did something that takes it out of the non-Jewish hands, but there hasn't been the transaction that put it into mine. Mm-hmm. All right? So the rule was that if a Jew bought land from a Jew, it remained in the ownership until the seller or the purchaser received the title deed, and it could retract until that time. But if a heathen sold the land to a Jew, neither could retract. So as soon as the money had been paid, though in this case too, the Jew did not become owner until he received the title deed. Hence, in the interval, the land is like the desert, and the first occupier becomes the owner. Squatter's rights. He, however, must reimburse the purchaser. Said Abai to Rav Yosef, did Samuel really say this? Had Samuel not laid down the law, that the law of the government is the law, and the king has ordained that land is not to be acquired save by means of a deed. So you have on one hand this particular halacha that seems to have been taught in the name of Shmuel, but that would go against Dina Damahu de Dina, because if according to the land of the law, land transference is only applicable when there's a deed, then it doesn't matter if halachically, once I give money over to a non-Jew, that wouldn't have any transactional effect, because the law of the land, according to the question here, would supersede the halachic requirement in terms of transference. Rav Yosef replied, I know nothing of that, as much as to say he did not believe that the king had ordained this. Meaning the question at hand isn't of the question of the law, it's a question on the mitziyut. That the assumption of the question that this in fact is the law, he said, well, I haven't heard of such a decree made. I only know that a case arose in Dura de... the translation here is terrible. Dura de Ra'uta.
Ravata?
Ravata, possibly. I don't know
That's
exactly what that is.
Right?
In which a Jew bought land from a heathen, and another Jew came and dug up a little of it. And when they came before a case came before Rabbi Yehudah, he assigned the land to the latter. Rabbi replied, "You speak of Dura Dura Vata, where the fields belonged to the people who hid themselves and did not pay tax to the king, and the king had ordered that whoever paid the tax, in that case of the Jew came and did the digging, should have the usufruct of the field. Hence, we cannot infer from this that the land bought from a heathen is not like a desert land. Then it also follow the other reasoning of Samuel, that the one who digs in it obtains only as much as he digs up. He replied, in that respect, I follow our own teaching laid down Rav Huna in the name of Rav. As soon as he dug up one spadeful, he becomes legal owner of the whole. So there's a discussion here based on an extrapolation of Dura de Rav. Ravata, whatever you want to pronounce it, which is kind of, the latter part is kind of tangential to how Dina del Malchuta is employed here. From Rav Yosef's, the case again is this. Jewish law would say, here's how the transaction works, and there's going to be a liminal state where the non-Jewish owner who's selling it no longer owns it, but me, the Jew, the buyer, has not yet acquired it. And technically, anyone else can come and claim it. Yes, they may have to pay the money back, but it's sort of like a for sale because now I own it. And the problem, I shouldn't say the problem, the way that the Gemara seems to work here, or at least the understanding of Dina del Malchuta, is the law of the land. It's if the law of the land would have been that the non-Jewish owner, you know, in order for him to lose, you know, the ownership of it, still needs a transfer of deed, that would have in some way superseded the previous law. Rav Yosef's response wasn't that that was a bad interpretation of the halacha, but rather that the king never actually said that, which meant it wasn't dina de mahuta, therefore it doesn't come into play. Implication being, if it were, then the law might have to be different. All right? And this is a case of real estate transactional law. Jewish law might be one thing, but you're dealing, also consider here, that you're dealing with a non-Jew. Right? Now, would you hold like a non-Jew accountable to Jewish law? But the truth is, the non-Jew is really not a factor here, because the non-Jew is selling it. The non-Jew has the land. The non-Jew gets his money. Right? So as far as he's concerned, his part of the transaction is fine. He doesn't care if another Jew goes up and takes land, because I sold the, like when you sell, you know, property, you don't really care who comes in afterwards. You just care. You get the money. You don't care whatever happens to it afterwards, as long as you get your fair market value for it. So perhaps that could be a factor as well here, because you're not talking about litigants of two Jews. You're talking about, you know, or at least the litigation of the two Jews would have to be, you know, the litigation with the two Jews would have to be like the squatter who comes in and tries to take over, where the first guy can claim, well, no, at the time you know, since there wasn't a deed transferred, it was still in the property of the non-Jew. Mm-hmm. But the actual dispute, if this would ever come to court, wouldn't be with the non-Jew at all, because the non-Jew doesn't care. The non-Jew, like, he has his money, or like, he's okay with it. It would be a dispute between two Jews here. Mm-hmm. And the Dina de Malchuta would affect that case insofar as the original transaction would have been with a non-Jew. Make sense? Mm-hmm. Okay. So far, you know, as far as when we... These are the only instances of Dina del Malchuta Dina, at least in that particular idiom, how it's applied in the Gemara. Again, we mentioned conceptually about following other government laws. You know, sometimes, you know, the Jews did, sometimes the Jews didn't, particularly in the case of, say, pogroms or other sorts of persecution. You know, and you know, people do make that point. Like, if you really want to say that in all cases the law of the land supersedes Jewish law, well, you don't really need Jewish law anymore. The cases here all seem to be in matters of finance. In some cases, in terms of taxes, it refers to a specific relationship between the king and, you know, Jewish subjects. Mm-hmm. There is a sense of setting up some degree of a legal system, one of the Sheva Mitzvot B'nei Noach, that, you know, perhaps that's why you can rely on their contracts. And here, you know, there's a certain, you know, certainly with exchanges with non-Jews, following the land of the law may have a halachic implication between two Jews if there was a non-Jew involved somehow in the transactional process. Where even though technical Jewish law might make, you know, might have one application, it could affect, even if it, you know, if there's a non-Jew involved, even though that non-Jew might not be a litigant in front of a Jewish court. All right? So those are the specific examples of Dina del Malchuta Dina. If you want to take a minimalist position, you could say, well, since these are the only types of cases, you know, you might not be able to extrapolate that much further. Right? Or you can say, well, no, there's a, you know, you may say, well, there's a general principle of the law of the land being the law, assuming, you know, there's no Jewish law, you know, that is overridden because of it, you know, and there's no particular threat to it, because none of these actually encroached on Jewish law.
Right. Right? They specifically excluded the mm-hmm. marriage and things like that.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, The main thing of like contract stuff is like, you know, taxes. Like, it's not usher to pay taxes. Well, in some cases it might be based on the very beginning of Bava Batra, but that's a whole for certain separate discussion on the topic there. But yeah, for the most part, like, there's no real conflict here. So you could argue, well, if there's not a case of conflict, then sure, you have to do with the law of the land of this law. Any ideas here about whether or not this is a ritual obligation or more of a civil one? I mean, one of the questions I introduced at the beginning is, would you say it's an Iser Derabanan to go 65 into 55 zone? Do you think that would be applicable here based on the cases we've seen?
No.
Why?
Well, because they're so specifically limited to to contracts. I mean, the
or tax. Well, you've got contracts and taxes, basically. And taxes. Transactions and taxes. Because the Gemara in Bava Batra 54b and 54a is about the transaction between a Jew and a non-Jew. Mm-hmm. So you've got taxes and transactions, right? And what it seems is that the government rules over paying taxes and transactions is something that Jewish law expects you to keep. But does that also mean necessarily that if you don't, you actually violate rabbinic law?
No. Possibly, because getting a driver's license is, you know, supervised by the state, and as part of getting a driver's license, you agree to adhere to the law.
Yeah, but that's not... It's a different type of question.
Your driver's license...
But the question is that, is there a ritual prohibition involved? Like, an Easter Durabanan, like, would it be on a level, like, let's say, you know, Shabbos, right? There are a lot of ways to violate Shabbos, right? Some of them are biblical, some of them are rabbinic, right? So would you say that, you know, speeding is similar to violating Shabbat rabbinically, like carrying in a carmelite? Right, that's a rabbinic prohibition with a religious, you know, implication behind it. Would you say that that's what's going on in Dina de Mahuta? Would you say it's more descriptive or prescriptive? Is it something that the sages themselves would necessarily enforce, or is it something that they tell everyone else to do? It's like, oh yeah, you actually have to follow the laws. In the cases of transactions, they're not even so much. It's not something that's enforced as much as upheld. Right, in terms of the way that they're going to offer, which is a, you know, very different type of approach.
Well, there is government enforcement, but your driver's license could, and maybe it's a stretch, but your driver's license could be a shtar of sorts.
But there's not a halachic component to that, is there? I mean, you're not going to Basin, you know, because you speed.
No.
At least I don't know anyone who has. Yeah.
Right. But would you have the same equivalency between like any of the transactional laws that are described in the Talmud in various areas, where they go into detail about contracts and things like that? Would you give that an equivalence to Shabbos, or as far as halachic strength?
That's a good point. That's a good point. Maybe not. Unless it's this general, you know, principle of like do what the, you know, sages tell you to do.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's we you know, spoke here a few times about, you know, the lines get blurred between civil, criminal, and religious law.
Right.
You know, like the massive gray area. You could say that, you know, if it's a purely like under a Jewish thing and you don't follow Jewish law, you can say you're breaking halacha. Right. So right. To what extent is Dina de Mahuta Dina, you know, just, you know, de facto of like this is something that you have to do and you have to follow? Or maybe it's in fact you consider it to be embedded as part of religious law that this is something you have to do it.
Right. Right.
So we're not going to answer, you know, that definitively. But, you know, there, I mean, you could, you know, spin it either way. Yeah.
I and would then, just yeah, think that would be hard to you know, give a definitive answer to your question, partly because the Torah has so many laws that appear to be just sort of commerce and transactions and civil law.
Yeah.
Okay, this might be hair splitting, but
in a class about halacha?
Right.
Shocking. Halacha is based on this. I mean, this is how you come up with the distinctions here.
Okay, so here's the hair split of the moment. The language, at least in the translations, often make reference to the courts of the Goyim and not the courts of the state. The courts of the Goyim sort of maybe imply...
We'll get there a little bit later.
Okay.
Hold off on that question. We might touch on that. All right, so certain degree of parameters here. This is actually, you know, back up to you, and so it's good because you raised this question. Shmuel Aleph 8:10 through 22 has, to give a little background here, the people at this point complained to Samuel, "We want a king," and, you know, was pretty, you know, God and Samuel were kind of upset about this, and in a way of discouraging it, Samuel then goes in and, you know, says, "Well, here's everything that a king is supposed to do." This is called by the Meiri Parshat Melech. These are, you know, things of the king. Why is this important? Because when you think about Dina de Malchuta Dina, right, the laws of, you know, the king, I mean, it's not just laws of the government. I mean, you could argue, like, does that apply to, you know, democratically elected governments or not? But focusing just on a king for a moment, what are certain things that a king does? And so, to some degree, you know, Bass is a little bit of like, there's a passage here where Shmuel describes, you know, the well, you can argue whether or not this is the powers of the king that he's entitled to do, or, or these are things that he's going warning. To do. You're, exactly. So, but it seems to be, you know, based on this passage here, things that a king does, whether or not, should you not pull that off, but these seem to be stuff that you could expect a king to do. Not all that positive. Only take us off. This is Samuel, 1 Samuel chapter 8, 10 through 22.
Samuel told all the words of the Lord to the people who were asking him for a king. He said, "This is what the king who will reign over you will claim as his rights. He will take your sons and make them serve with his chariots and horses, and they will run in front of them, run in front of his chariots. Some he will assign to the command to be commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties, and others to plow his ground and reap his harvest, and still others to make weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive groves and give them to his attendants. He will take a tenth of your grain and of your vintage and give it to his officials and attendants. Your male and female servants and the best of your cattle and donkeys he will take for his own use. He will take a tenth of your flocks, and you yourselves will become his slaves. When that day comes, you will cry out for relief from the king you have chosen, but the Lord will not answer you in that day." But the people refused to listen to Samuel. "No," they said, "we want a king over us. Then we will be like all the other nations with a king to lead us and go out before us and fight our battles." Mm-hmm. When Samuel heard all that the people said, he repeated it before the Lord. The Lord answered, "Listen to them and give them a king." Then Samuel said to the Israelites, "Everyone go back to your own town."
I could probably, you know, cut out, you know, 19 through the end here.
No, but, I love
you know,
that.
Yeah, it's a good ending there. Yeah,
they
didn't really work out so well, did you? So you go through all the things that a king does. So first you have a draft. Now, a military draft means, basically, you know, he can, you know, send you out to die. He can, you know, conscript, you know, people for pretty much anything. Take your land, take your people, and you could, in theory, function like slaves. This is well beyond, you know, basic taxation here, right? Which, you know, you want to play Parashat Melech. Well, it seems that, you know, law of the, like, if it's really Dina Demachut Dina, it would apply to, you know, a whole bunch of other, you know, things here. We'll talk about that a little bit later. Dana, this is a kind of deal. Moving on now. So one, I guess, parameter. One parameter you can discuss here is, you know, these are things that a king, you know, seems to be under his auspices. Question, and, you know, right, debate this, do you think this applies specifically to a Jewish king or also to a non-Jewish king, if you're going to rely on this particular passage?
Well, I think that it's inevitable that if a Jewish king didn't exist yet when he was describing this, mm-hmm. So he was saying that this is, you know, just a king in general. That's what they do.
Exactly. I think that's a very good point, because the whole complaint of the people was, set us up a king
so we should be like the other nations.
Bingo. Yeah. So we should be like the other nations. By implication, this is what every king, you know, does.
And God said this is a good idea?
No, God was kind of upset with it. We, you know, had Shaul, who started off okay.
But he said Shema B'Kolah.
Well,
do what they say.
Yeah, well, you know, there's a huge discussion on this, because, you know, you've got the, you know, psukim of how it's like, oh yes, and when the people go and say, like, set us a king so we should be like everyone else, refer to the Mefarshim on this particular passage.
Okay.
Moving on to a very important parameter here is a Gemara in Gittin 88b. Dana, this, I think, was the point that, you know, you were trying to get to.
Hi. Rav Tarfon used to say, in any place where you find heathen law courts, even though their law is the same as the Israelite law, you must not resort to them, since it says, "These are the judgments which thou shalt set before them." That is to say, before them and not before heathen.
So, despite the fact that Dina del Malchut Dina, you know, even said, let's say just transactional, because, you know, courts aren't going to deal with, you know, taxes in terms of being tax collectors. It doesn't mean that, you know, you're supposed to lechatchila initially go to these courts. And this is actually a major source of, like, why, you know, people get put into cherem, you know, for going to a civil court over a, you know, Jewish court, over a beis din, right? Because if it's really Dina de Mahutadina, then maybe we can understand logically why you don't want civil law to trump Jewish law in that, excuse me, of ritual. Meaning if civil law says, like, outlaws say circumcision, you're still going to do it, right? But you're talking here, let's say it's about transactional law. Let's say it's transactional law that doesn't even conflict with Jewish law. Let's say it's identical. You're still supposed to go to a Jewish court before going to a non-Jewish court, mm-hmm. right? And you know, you mentioned earlier about, you know, this line being blurred here about the civil versus the religious. There is a religious component to Jewish law.
Right.
Right?
Well, because, I mean, it's just like the way the whole cosmologies. I mean, the Torah is a way of life, and the whole thing is a whole. Mm-hmm. And that's sometimes like when we separate like religious from day to day civil matters. Mm-hmm. I think it for a long time that wasn't a factor, that separation.
Right.
The you know, like sometimes when you talk about like even custom versus halacha and stuff like that, when you're in a community, this is what people do, and mm-hmm. They're expected to do certain things, and this whole a lot of these distinctions go away when you're in a in a sort of holistic society, not like we are now, where we're fractured already, and we separate like religion mm-hmm. from this and from that.
So sure. Yeah.
Well, what bothered me was when you said something like, except when it infringes on ritual matters.
Yes.
Well, what about the laws in the Torah about how much a robber is supposed to pay back? Mm. Is that a civil or a ritual?
So the truth is, it would kind of be both in a way. Like, you know, when to go to non-Jewish courts, you know, the whole basin thing is, you know, separate. I think were you here when we started going through like the laws of Sanhedrin? Like that, we spent like about, you know, a couple of months on that. I remember, I think it was a question that, you know, Ed brought up a while ago. He's, you know, like, well, and he put it in a great way of like, why do you have to listen to the rabbis when the rabbis tell you to listen to the rabbis? So, you know, took it for like, you know, consider the source. So, I mean, of the rabbis in point, not Ed. You know, but you go through the whole, you know, so because of that, we actually went through like all of Hilchot Sanhedrin and, you know, the parallels between the, you know, non-Jewish courts and like you. Yeah, that's much, much bigger question. But yeah. All right, take us to Rambam. This is Laws of Theft and Lost Objects. Ilchot Gzela Ve'Aveda, last one, 5:18, where he discusses a little bit about, you know, Dinan de Mahutin following the government.
Correct the English number. It says 118.
118. Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you. It's 5:18, not 118.
Hmm. When were these things stated? Only for a king whose authority extends in these lands where the people of that land have agreed, and they assume that this person is their master and they are his slaves. But if his authority does not extend, then he is like a thief and a thug, and like any band of robbers whose laws are not laws, and any king such as this is like a thief in all regards.
So this is an important Rambam,
really,
in that in order for it to really be a din de malchut, I mentioned that question of what's considered a government, Rambam is going to say it has to be a legitimate government.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Now, based on this Rambam, you know, even though it's not like, you know, you viewed necessarily yourselves as slaves, that was kind of, you know, almost evoking the language from Shmuel, right? You know, how you're going to be treated, whether or not that could apply to a democracy. Because in a democracy, you might not like the guy in charge, but there's a certain respect for the process. And you acknowledge that so-and-so is, in fact, the leader. One of my favorite analogies is given by my father's Rabbi Chacham Yosef Faur in Israel. It was a discussion I had in 2001. He gave a distinction between, you know, a law professor and a judge in terms of conceptual Jewish law, that a law professor could easily argue why Al Gore ought to have won the election. But it was the judge who actually made the final decision, such that you could say as much as you want, here's why Al Gore ought to have won, but no law professor would have actually said Al Gore was in fact the president. Mm-hmm. Right? As, you know, without getting into the details, I understand, you know, however badly even the most, you know, ardent critic of George Bush and W. Bush and everything else that he did and the whole thing behind the election, end result was he was still the president. And with the exception of just a few, I mean, people would be crackpots for this reason to say George Bush wasn't in fact president. He was president. You might not like, you know, what happened there, but, you know, the process, you know, took its toll. We could argue about how absolutely corrupt it was and to what extent does corruption, delegitimize the entire governmental system. Yeah.
Okay, again, not to get into this in great detail, but can we at least say that George W. Bush was appointed rather than elected?
I don't think so. My understanding of it isn't that it wasn't that the Supreme Court appointed him. It was they made a decision regarding how to handle the ballots in Florida.
They said to stop the count.
Right. That doesn't
or
mean
the recount.
But he wasn't made by an appointment of the Supreme Court. It was a decision made based on other laws. It wasn't a Supreme Court appointment. It was the Supreme Court making a decision based on to solve an electoral question. Yes, I mean, people will argue that for, rhetoric purposes. It's like, oh, the Supreme Court chose that. That's not what happened. They made a decision regarding the electoral process. And it's the electoral process that gave it the legitimacy. I imagine there are, just as you've got a lot written on Dina Demokuta, there's probably, I would guess I wouldn't be surprised if you had more written on, Bush v. Gore or Gore v. Biden. I don't even know which one it is. Well, one versus the other, though, Supreme Court case. This is why, I should put in the thing, for my next contract year of, like, the show should pay me to go to law school just so I can, know all this cool stuff. And keep it all in my mind. Yeah. See if that'll ever fly.
Well, I don't know. We did have a law professor here.
Yeah, this is true. Well, yeah, he didn't come to... people have discussed that at length. But it wasn't a Supreme Court appointment. The Supreme Court's decision might have ended the debate, and that might have been the rule, but it wasn't that the Supreme Court picked the president.
I think all the machinery used was legitimate. It might have been a faulty decision, but it was within the legitimate machinery of deciding these things. It wasn't... They didn't short circuit and just say, okay, he's president. It's not that way.
Machinery is a funny word given how we...
As is circuits, considering...
No, I mean, it might have, the circuits might have misfired or whatever, but it was still, like a due process. It doesn't mean because a guilty person goes free, it doesn't mean that due process wasn't followed. And, it's still that is the legitimate decision, of course, even though it's a faulty decision, right? It's a big difference between...
But there are also other qualifications here. Take up the last source. This is Magid Mishnah. So this is one of the commentators on the Rambam's Mishnah Torah on an earlier halacha on 513. It's Rav Vidal of Talus, who was born around 1300s.
And this is the essence of the law of the land being law. But the theft of a kingdom is not law. And it is like pure theft.
So there does seem to be a distinction, and this gets into that due process thing. It has to at least go through due process. There cannot be, theft is not considered legitimate, in this case. Now, it doesn't mean you're necessarily going to have recourse to it, because governments are generally going to be more powerful than an individual. But there seems to be, at least according to the Magid Mishnah, he's throwing in another thing here, is that there has to be some, legitimacy to an action of a government. So, today, you've got a whole bunch of taxes, right? People have critiqued the bailouts, where, we basically took money from future generations in the form of debt and gave it to, certain big corporations who already have lots of money. Now, you could say, well, if this was, transfer of wealth, you can say, you're stealing money. It's like, no, you didn't actually steal the money. You are making, you're putting on a tax for a certain purpose, just like the government always does. You can disagree with it. You can think it's, immoral. You can think that it is, bad for a whole slew of reasons. But going back to the Parshat HaMelech, what was the thing that it says he'll do? He'll take the best of your fields and your olive groves and give them to your give them to his attendants. Said otechem et karmechem zeitechem atovim yikach v'natan la'avadav. That's kind of what happened with the bailout, right? And it seems to be under the auspices of what a king can do. So, I'm not sure.
It's like a negative contract theory, in a Leviathan and other social contract kind of thing. The ideal kingdom is where the government has absolute authority, but it's with the consent of the government because they want to be protected. They want all these things. Mm. But in the Jewish form, it's we warn you that if you take this option of being children and being taken care of by somebody, that this is what's going to happen. I love it.
A suggested correction to the translation.
Please, always.
Theft of a kingdom is kind of an awkward phrase.
Theft
by the government or by the king.
set by the king. All right, yeah, I'll fix that up.
Oh, but that right. changes the meaning a lot. Right?
Well, because it's self-efficacy. Well, yeah, I mean, like, either way, I mean, I guess. Because the government wouldn't actually engage in theft if it's done through due process. Mm-hmm. Although, and well, I guess it depends where you are. I mean, in the U.S., we have something called a Bill of Attainder, which is, you know, the way of, you know, not singling out a particular individual. And there's actually one of the, there is a, one of the commentators actually does say that, that the law would be legitimate if it applies to everyone and not to a specific party. It has to be done with dark claw, but if it's a specific law for an individual, and that's kind of the whole Bill of Attainder thing, that came up recently with Acorn, where people wanted to, there was a move to specifically prohibit federal funding from Acorn, and one of the objections is that's illegal. You can't have a law that singles out a specific organization. Mm-hmm. You can say, we can't, we are not going to support any business that engages in X, Y, or Z, but you can't say specifically that business by name. It's like, you can't specifically say, we're not going to allow Walmart, but you can say, we're not going to allow any company that has the following qualifications. Right, it's not that its name is spelled W-A-L-L, like, you know, it goes to, it's like a company that does blah, 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 that, you know, is general enough. So that idea of, you know, or at least in this context, does have some, you know, some textual support in halachic sources. I threw in here, you know, for further reading, there was an article in the very first Journal of Halacha and Contemporary Society by Rav Herschel Schachter that deals with this and some other issues. You know, and has, you know, his own take on this. But you can see, you know, just how much there is to discuss on this matter. Going back to the first thing about the contraception case, if it was really a pure halachic idea, meaning if it was halachically problematic for us, you know, for Jewish organization to provide or even to facilitate, you know, contraception insurance, then it would be prohibited for us to actually follow that law. Now, we kind of proved last week why it doesn't violate Jewish law, and, you know, how no Orthodox organization said that it violates Jewish law. So, you know, that's kind of a non-starter. But were, you know, the civil court to require us to do things that would in fact violate Jewish law, we would not be able to do that. This Jewish law would certainly take certain precedence. You would just have to make sure that what in fact is being required does violate Jewish law. You know, and that requires a very specific idea. It's like, you know, you've got the biblical prohibitions, the rabbinic prohibitions, and you'd have to be able to show how doing so, not that you don't like it, not because it's tertiary, you're like, you know, four or five things down the line, but are they requiring you to do something that is in fact a sort? That's from a halachic perspective, not from a separation of church and state perspective, because that was, we spoke about last week, one of the sub discussions about the contraception issue is the government trying to pass off, well, this is religious mandate or this is not religious mandate. Like, you know, one of the arguments given was that, well, since 90% of Catholic women use birth control already, it doesn't really matter. And the counter argument is like, no, the government is not supposed to determine what Catholic law is and whether or not people do it is irrelevant. This is what Catholic law is. You have to leave up the religion to determine, you know, what exactly they believe. I'm talking about from the halachic perspective. Yeah.
No, never mind.
Okay. All right. So thank you all very much. Have a wonderful Purim. Let me pause this now.